uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast. On Sirius Satellite Radio, on RadioPower.org, on CRN Digital, NIYRiseSociety.org, with podcasting on Apple iTunes. Welcome back to our program. Our toll-free number, 1-866-889-8894. The website, TomHartman.com, however you spell it, will get you there. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room or participate in our message blogs, our message boards, feel free. It's all there. And also, if you click on Articles on Democracy in the upper right-hand corner of TomHartman.com, you'll get to some of my more recent writings on these kinds of issues. With us is Dr. Robert Garmong. Dr. Robert Garmong is with the... Am I pronouncing your last name right? Robert?
Pardon me, Tom?
Hey, Robert.
Hi.
Hey. Do you have a bad telephone?
No, I just got some little static on the line.
Oh, okay. All right. Every now and then we'll get somebody on as a guest who's on a cell phone, and we got to ask, you know, please don't do that. Call back on a real telephone. In any case, am I pronouncing your last name right, Garmong?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Robert is with the Ayn Rand Group, A-Y-N-R-A-N-D, the Ayn Rand Institute.
That's right.
And I see that you're working on a book called John Stuart Mill's Reconceptualization of Liberty. And I got to tell you, I read two years ago, I read John Stuart Mill's On Liberty for the first time, actually all the way through. And it was like reading the Bible, the first time I read the Bible all the way through. It took me a year to do it, because there are these, every now and then you get these nuggets, you know, where you don't want to put it down. But most of the time it's like slogging through molasses. And John Stuart Mill's writing style is so dense. But so it took me like 2 months to read his book. I mean, every night I'd read it for like 20, 30 minutes and I'd fall asleep, you know, because it put me to sleep. But his book On Liberty was really radically different from Ayn Rand's thoughts. How can you pull this stuff together?
Well,
I mean, he was all about the commons and the community and the commonwealth and all that kind of stuff.
That's right. And I agree with you. I'm not an advocate of Mill's view of liberty, and I think that the thrust of my work is to say that John Stuart Mill, who wrote in the 19th century and has been commonly considered more of a classical liberal or libertarian type of thinker, I argue is actually more of a contemporary liberal, more on your side than on my side.
Oh, okay. So we're in agreement then. That's interesting because it was a disconnect for me there when I read that. Yeah, because John Stuart Mill, I mean, I believe On Liberty was published in 1861. It was right around that time in any case. And he introduced the concept of, in fact, he was the first to introduce the concept, not in that book, but in another book, the concept of proportional representation, for example. Widely used all over the world now, except in the United States. But in any case, what we were going to talk about today is illegal immigration. We have now in the United States roughly 10% of the population of Mexico living in this country and working here and sending back to illegally living in this country and working here and sending back to Mexico an amount of money. It's my recollection is around $18 billion. Whatever the exact amount is, that adds up to about 10% of Mexico's GDP, that Mexican workers, illegal immigrants from Mexico here in the United States, are sending back more money to Mexico than Mexico makes on its oil industry, which is its largest industry. So its largest industry really is exporting illegal labor. Thus, Vicente Fox publishing a booklet telling people how to sneak across the American border, how to survive in the United States, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I see this as a major problem, and I'm assuming that you do too.
Yes, it is a major problem. And in my view, the problem is not so much the economic aspect of it, the money going back to Mexico, but the problem is we've created a criminal class by creating this huge underclass of illegal immigrants, most of whom are here wanting to be full citizens and wanting to be participants in the economy, productive individuals, but we've turned them into, in effect, criminals for the mere act of being here and breathing, whatever they do subsequently.
Now, I think it's interesting to point out Ayn Rand Foundation, Ayn Rand's writings, the Atlas Shrugged being the main one, that have influenced political thought, strongly influenced the libertarian movement, which has strongly influenced the conservative movement, which has obviously strongly influenced the Bush administration. And really, you're taking the same position that George Bush is, which is, hey, let's just give all these people amnesty, and now we've got 10 million new workers here in the United States, right?
Well, I'm not sure that I would say we should give full amnesty or simply with one blanket act make them legal. But I do think that we have a serious problem, and we're not going to solve it by simply clamping down, by fining people, by fining employers, by deporting people. We've tried all that.
No, we
it
haven't.
It doesn't work.
We haven't. We have not. You know, it's like the folks who are opposed to gun control. They say, we've got all these laws on the books about guns. We're not enforcing them. And there's some truth to that. There's a whole lot more truth to the point that we have laws on the books that say it's illegal to hire an illegal alien, and yet nobody's enforcing those laws. I mean, there's no state that I know of that's actually enforcing those laws.
There certainly is not the kind of aggressive enforcement that some people would call for, but I think that that's really all beside the point.
No, but well, here the point, it sounds to me, like you're saying, Robert Garmong, is that you don't want the employers to be held accountable for illegally hiring illegal aliens. Because the employers, in your mind, really democracy should be set aside as a form of government, and we should allow free enterprise and capitalism to run the country, and therefore what's ever in the best interest of the big corporations is the best thing for America. Am I mischaracterizing your point of view?
Well, I would not say anything so blanket as what's in the, you know, what's in the interest of GM is in the interest of America. Not necessarily, but I do think that our focus is wrong if we're focusing on clamping down. That's not going to solve the problem. The problem is that we have these oppressive restrictions, and I'm not concerned about the employer side of this. I'm concerned about the, first and foremost, on a personal level at least, I'm concerned about the plight of these people who simply want to come and work, and we've made that into a crime.
But what about the plight of the people who used to have good jobs in the United States who no longer have those jobs because we have so many illegal immigrants in the United States, for example, that they've broken up most of the construction trade unions around the United States because there's so much labor to do that you can't, you know, a union, by definition, I suppose, in post-Taft-Hartley, operates best in an environment where there's a certain scarcity of labor. And the driving down the average wages. It's you know, what about the poor Americans who are losing their jobs to illegal immigrants?
Well, that is an interesting point, but I think it's based on a wrong view of economics. The job market is not a fixed pot. There aren't a fixed number of jobs available, and someone coming over and grabbing one is taking it away from someone else. There's a continual guaranteed scarcity of labor based on the simple fact that human desires and needs are limitless, essentially.
Then why do we have about 10 million unemployed people in the United States?
Well, that's a whole different issue involving labor unions as one cause of it.
Labor represents 8% of the non-federal workforce right now in the United States. Come on.
We can have a whole different discussion on unemployment if you want, minimum wage laws being a cause of the problem, et cetera. But my point is with regard to immigration is that every immigrant who comes to this country and is a productive member of society is a boon because they're adding to our life standard of living. I'm sorry.
In other words, we can have cheap labor to clean our pools.
Absolutely. If we have pools, we have cheap labor to clean them. If we have the more people working in this country, the better. The more people producing value, the better. We look at things in monetary terms. Monetary wages are going down.
Isn't there a reasonable point, though, Robert, where you say, we have enough people now, thank you very much?
I don't think there is such thing as enough people.
Have you ever lived or worked in a third world country, Robert?
We talked about, I have visited, I haven't lived there. We talked last week about Julian Simon, and he made the very good point that the ultimate resource is the human mind. And the more human minds we have, and the freer they are to use their minds and to work and to add to our national product, the better we are.
Well, now there's where it breaks down, because that if-then that you just engaged in is fallacious. Here's what, and that was my problem with Julian Simon. I agree that the ultimate resource is the human mind, the human intellect. I mean, you look around you, everything you see, by and large, is the result of somebody having thought of something. You know, pretty much everything that's not part of the natural world anyway. But, you know, by suggesting that therefore more minds is going to mean more quality of thought, you know, I really don't think so. I mean, I have actually lived and worked in third world, in hell holes, in Bogota, Colombia, in Bombay, India. And I can tell you that a kid born in the slums of Bombay, India, may have the intellect of Einstein, is never going to have the opportunity to figure out the theory of relativity. They may have the intellect of Donald Trump. He actually inherited that money from his father. But, you know, they may have the intellect of Bill Gates. Well, he actually was a very, you know, upper middle class kid who bought something. But in any case, you get the point that they may have, you know, great intellectual capacity. That doesn't mean that they're going to be able to succeed, because they're living in a world where the resources are so scarce because there's so many people.
It's not the number of people that cause the resources to be scarce. It's the culture, and it's the particularly the legal environment that causes people to be oppressed.
Then why is it that after the Black Death in Europe, the Renaissance came about? That when the number of people dropped by about a third, and the human to resource ratio dramatically improved, that suddenly people had time for the arts, people had time for philosophy, science emerged. All this stuff evolved as a result, or emerged as a result of the Black Plague.
Oh, Tom, you're not telling me that people suddenly had time for art and literature because large percentage of the population died off?
Yeah, I am telling you that. In the two generations that followed the Black Death, that's exactly what happened. Read any good history of it.
There's an interesting phenomenon that people aren't really aware of, and that is that the Black Plague did have an effect on the Renaissance in a rather strange sort of way. It made paper readily available because of all the rags that had to be disposed of, which meant that the price of books went down tremendously, and the invention of the printing press, which was right around the same time, allowed the distribution of knowledge and learning, and that's what freed the human mind and allowed for the Renaissance to take place.
So,
but the Renaissance was not caused by death. The Renaissance was caused by the freedom of the mind.
Interesting. Interesting how differently we can view these things. I'm assuming you have not read Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steel?
No, I haven't.
Okay. You might find it interesting. We're talking with Robert Garmong.
It is on my shelf.
Okay, yeah, it's a great book. We're talking with Robert Garmong of the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. And, Robert, can you stick around for 10 minutes here?
Sure.
Okay. Well, we'll take a break, and then we'll come back, and we'll take a few calls, and we'll wrap this conversation up. We're talking about, you know, how should we deal with illegal immigrants? Or should we simply, as the Bush administration is suggesting, say, hey, they're not illegal anymore. The more labor, the better. 20 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Psycho cowboy, yippee, I whoopee, whoopee, tie, whoopee, whoopee, tie. Don't you? Don't run, run away.
Yeah, look out for those psycho cowboys. Actually, you can't call George W. Bush a cowboy because he's afraid of horses. That's why there's no horses at his so-called ranch, his hobby ranch. Anyhow, we're talking with Robert Garmong of the Ayn Rand Foundation, or Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. And, Robert, you're suggesting that the bottom line of your suggestion is that this old-fashioned idea of countries having borders is just kind of silly, isn't it? We should just do away with borders and just let corporations run everything.
Well, I always find it interesting to hear how you characterize my side of any argument, Tom, but the way I would put it is that borders are legal entities, and they should exist, but I think that they should be essentially free. I think essentially immigration should be free, and that was the policy of this country that we had right up until the early part of the 20th century. And I think that it absolutely sickens me to think of the number of good, hardworking people, and not all Mexican migrant workers, although they're worldwide, we're keeping out because of our largely racist and our erroneous economic notions that they're somehow going to be a drain on our economy.
So you think that if half the white European Caucasian population of the impoverished country of Bulgaria were to show up tomorrow, that it would have no economic, it would actually be a net positive for us. Just like if half of the population of Bangladesh was to show up tomorrow, that would have no problem. That would be no problem. It would be a good thing for us.
Well, certainly if they showed up all in one very large boat, that would be a bad, it would be a bad day. And it would be probably an adjustment. But absolutely, immigration has always been a boon to this country, and it will be a boon as long as we allow it. And I think we should allow it on a much greater scale than we are now. We complain about the exporting of good jobs and the exporting of particularly now computer, high-paying computer engineering type jobs to India and so on. Many of the people who started companies in India tried to come here, couldn't, and so they were forced to create their new companies elsewhere. We're forcing...
Well, a lot of the companies that are being started in India are actually being started by Americans and American companies, too. I mean, they're just taking advantage of Indian labor. I mean, let's be real here. So you're suggesting, it sounds to me like you're suggesting basically that the whole idea of national borders ultimately is a silly idea.
Oh, no, I think that certainly as long as we have a world in which some countries have different policies than others, we have to have national borders.
Why?
I wouldn't want, for instance, to have China voting on our laws. I certainly wouldn't want that. So... I'm definitely not an internationalist in that sense, but I do believe that we should have freedom of immigration into this country.
Yeah, okay. Patricia in Colorado's on the line. Hey, Patricia, welcome to the program. We have about a minute left. What's up?
I'm 68 years old at this point, and I lived on the border of Mexico and the United States for 27 years. And I was also born in a border city, and I could not disagree with this gentleman more. I watched city after city. I shall only name one, El Paso. I was born in that city many years ago, and it used to be a nice place, but it isn't a nice place now. And I left it, sold my home to get away from what was happening down there. If you think for one instant that these people don't have an agenda, you're badly mistaken. The schools are being overwhelmed with illegal aliens, and the schools, by law, from this country, must educate those children.
Right. Patricia, thank you for your comment. Robert, 10 seconds for a response.
Well, I think it goes back to my earlier point. We've turned them into criminals. We've turned them into a drag on our economy by making their very existence here illegal. And if we did away with that, it's just like drug policy. We would do away with a lot of the crime problems and other social problems.
Okay. Robert Garmong with the Ayn Rand Foundation or Institute, IEYNRAND.org. 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
My fellow Americans, check it. As your president, I've been real busy, so I thought I'd take a minute to let y'all know what I've been up to. For starters, I turned the strongest economy in history into the biggest deficit in history and lost over 2.5 million jobs. My good friend, Ken Lay, was in charge of that whole Enron thing. I invaded two countries, made a joke at the United Nations, broke the Geneva Conventions, and I still managed to take more vacation than any other president. So, to summarize, terrorist, 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 9/11, 9/11, and God bless America. Thank you.
You gave them the old razzle dazzle. You razzle dazzled.
Oh, George, you did so good.
You gave them an act with lots of flash in it. Made them believe you were compassionate.
Right there in Utah, just day before yesterday.
Hocus pocus, you misdirected them.
with 9/11 and Saddam Hussein. You played them both right to perfection, despite the fact there's no connection. You razzle-dazzled them, let those blue states complain.
Yeah.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Yes, welcome back, my friends. 26 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Our phone number, 1-866-889-8894. I just want to share with you my take on all this, for what it's worth. The basic human instinct, one of the basic human instincts, it's burned into our DNA. You see this in all animals. The basic human instinct is the instinct to form community. At the smallest level, it's called family. And then you have neighborhood or tribe or clan, and then you have, you know, states and nations, and, you know, there's different words for it in different societies at different times, but it's a basic human instinct to form community and to have some form of governance for that community, to decide who's going to be making decisions, how those decisions are made, and what the policies are going to be of those communities. And as the United States of America, we created this community. We call it our country, the United States. And we have very specific ways we run this country. And Mexico runs their country in very different ways. And I think, you know, we just have to acknowledge that. And Mexico is basically a plutocracy, an oligarchy. There's like 34 wealthy families that basically own everything, or the majority of everything in Mexico, and basically run the country and have for a century or more. Now, we're moving in that direction in the United States, but that's not the way that we intended for this country to be. And my hope is that, you know, we'll turn away from that in the United States and go back to our ideals of democracy. And so, and one of the reasons why is because oligarchy doesn't work. What it does is you have, you know, a small number of very rich people and a whole lot of very poor, impoverished, terrified folks. And what do they want to do? Well, they want to come someplace else, like here. And I am of the opinion that we should not have 10 million illegal Mexicans, by and large, also from other countries in South America. And this has nothing to do with race. If the Canadians were doing it, I'd be saying the same thing, that we should not have illegal aliens in the United States. There's a whole lot of good reason. You can talk about security. I think that that's a bit of a red herring. The reality is that, you know, somebody wants to get us. They don't need to be an illegal alien to do it. But all the 9/11 hijackers came here on legal visas, for example. But, you know, the reality is that there's a whole bunch of reasons for this, but the biggest reason is that this is our country. We're running it the way we want to run it. We have to live with the consequences of that. We fight for that. We fought for it. We built this country. And we, as the all of us, we, all colors, all races, all religions, all of us, we, who are here together now in this country, we're all in it together. And when you know, 10% of Mexico shows up and comes into our job market, it creates a significant dislocation in our job markets. Now, that works to the benefit of multinational corporations and to the detriment, in my opinion, of democracy. So what do you do about it? Well, people say, well, you know, round them all up and deport them. I'm sorry, they're just going to come back. That won't work. Plus, it'll cost about $50 billion. The easy way is to dry up the demand. It's the same thing that the Mexicans are saying about our drugs. You know, they're saying, well, you know, you're complaining about all the drugs that are going into America. If you stopped buying them, we wouldn't be able to sell any to you. Well, if we stopped employing illegal aliens, they would go away. There's a reason why in 1960 and 1950 and 1940 there wasn't a flood of illegal aliens across the Mexican border, because there were no jobs for them. Because we had strong labor unions that acted as a first line of defense against the contamination of the labor pool in the United States by illegals. And those have been wiped out. And because we had strong laws that were actually enforced. And the conservatives don't want to enforce these laws. In fact, George W. Bush wants to give them all amnesty. So I say, you know, simply clamp down on the employers. Make it a felony. And it is already in many places. But start, you know, actually throwing people in jail over it. Make it a felony to hire somebody who is an illegal alien. Period. For anything. And guess what? They're not going to hang out here anymore if they can't make the money. And it's not that I'm saying they're bad people or that they're mercenary. It's just human instinct. You follow the economics of it. Mike in Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Already shot a couple of holes in the idea that more people is better, about they're not necessarily educated, and they're, you know, it takes a while to implement, get them in.
Right.
Also, the idea is the world, the economists don't seem to realize the world is finite.
Yeah.
And then also the idea that more human minds can solve any problem. Well, first of all, minds don't work on demand. Second of all, it takes time to implement the solutions and money, and also working against the mores of society, such as stem cells and driving smaller cars.
Yeah, I, you know, it's I'm concerned about quality of life, not quantity of life,
yeah,
as it were. And I think that, you know, we have a real problem with, you know, whenever anybody comes along and says, oh, it's just, you know, all we need is more people. Thanks a lot, Mike. I appreciate your comments. Well said. In fact, here's the Adbusters has a great ad on this topic where they point out that economic growth is not everything.
For years, economists have defined the economic health of a country by its gross domestic product. Trouble is, every time a forest falls, the GDP goes up. With every oil spill, the GDP goes up. Every time a cancer patient is diagnosed, the GDP goes up. Is this how we measure economic progress? Economists must learn to subtract.
Yeah, very straightforward. Literally, every time somebody gets diagnosed with cancer, it increases the American economy. There's a lot of things that will increase the American economy. Are they good? Not necessarily. Mike in Los Angeles, California on the line. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Yeah, I really have to disagree with you, and I disagree with you from the left.
Okay.
You're behind what current labor unions are saying. In fact, undocumented workers, look at the Justice for Janitors campaign. They've been some of the most militant laborers. The problem is that they have to live in the shadows, and that frequently the employers are the ones who call the INS. So clamping down on immigration only actually helps the employers who want to employ workers who are easily exploited because they're afraid of being clamped down.
Hang on just a second, Mike or Mark. What you're saying is true if you're clamping down on the illegal immigrants. I'm not suggesting that we should be clamping down on the illegal immigrants themselves. I don't think that we have the resources or the money to do that. What I'm saying is that the employers who are hiring them should go to jail. And when that happens, the employers will stop offering them jobs, and they will say, hey, there's no money here. We're going back to Mexico.
You know, Bush also doesn't support legalization. What he wants is a return to the Bracero program, where the employees are tied to an employer.
That's right. He wants to create basically a slave labor class.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, the point is that we should legalize the people that are here. They're living, they're working here. We actually need them because America's an aging population. Our birth rate isn't very high. Otherwise, we'll end up looking like Europe, and we need to educate them.
Well, hang on just a second, Mark. I've lived in Europe. What's wrong with looking like Europe? Europe has a very high standard of living. Things are going very well, thank you very much, in Europe.
Yeah, but it's not quite sustainable because they have an aging population.
It's certainly sustainable. There's nothing wrong with having an aging population.
Europe needs immigrants. That's why immigration is accelerating.
No, it's actually that's not the case. What is the right wing talking points that are being put out by the corporatists, the big corporations who are looking for cheap labor, is that Europe needs immigrants, and that's what they're using to push the EU. And what it's doing is it's killing the economies of the fully developed countries like France and Germany and Italy at the expense of the undeveloped countries like Bulgaria and Romania and the former Czechoslovakia.
I mean, I'm not going to get into this, but I mean, you're basically wrong on the pension crisis that Europe has been facing recently. But the other thing is that look, from the left, think of it this way: if capital is mobile and can move easily across borders, shouldn't labor be able to do so as well?
Yeah, and my point is capital should not be mobile and able to move across borders like that, and that's what I've been saying.
I'm absolutely consistent in this, Mark. I agree with you on that, the situation we have now is that capital, it's free to move wherever it wants.
Right, and we need to fix that.
Exploit labor.
Right, we need to fix that.
But labor can't move.
Right, and we need to fix that. We don't fix that by saying, okay, it's a bad situation for us with regard to capital, so we're going to make it a bad situation for us with regard to labor.
The point is that undocumented immigrants, the point is that as long as they're here and they have rights, then, you know, most unions have decided to organize them. And in fact,
I know that, and I think it's a mistake.
Some of the most militant workers are much more militant than your average white guy.
I understand, and I think it's a mistake for the unions to get in on that. I think that there are some unions that are so desperate for members that they would embrace illegal immigrants, and I think it's a huge mistake. I think it's a short-term mistake.
So American-born white men have just been, you know, the sort of great union guys, right? I mean, they haven't been militant workers forever. They've been racist. They've been whatever.
Absolutely. And there are unions that have lots of African Americans in them, and there are unions that have lots of Hispanics in them. There are, you know, the union movement is not a racist movement, Mark.
African American, Latino, and immigrant workers have been the most militant workers in the U.S. They've been the ones pushing these policies. A majority of
which policies?
Even white, pushing positive policies, better wages, better working conditions. A majority of white labor union members vote Republican.
And they've got a huge wake up call coming.
Yeah, but
they got
Look,
Mark,
this is exactly why the Democratic Party can't get anywhere with Hispanic voters and black voters, because you guys always, the people who are really the new immigrants and the people who are really sort of joining the left and fighting for rights, fighting for health care, fighting for this, you guys turn your backs on them.
Well, first of all, Mark, I'm not the Democratic Party. I got nothing to do with the Democratic Party, number one.
No, but I'm saying...
I disagree with a lot of the...
I wouldn't even call you a real leftist.
Okay. I don't know...
Yeah, I wouldn't even call you a real leftist.
That's fine. I'm not a real leftist. I am me. And I'm sharing my opinion on this with you, and I got yours, and I appreciate that. But you still haven't explained to me, Mark, how it is that having more, you know, just a steady flood of labor coming into the United States, driving down the price of labor, is a good thing for the United States.
What's largely driven down the price of labor in the U.S. is the departure of the manufacturing sector. It's that the manufacturing jobs have left. And what they've been replaced by is low-wage service jobs.
No, what happened when they left is that the ratio of labor to jobs changed. Labor is a commodity just like anything else. And this is the point that the conservatives will make over and over. And in this point, they're right. And when you have a lot of labor relative to a diminished demand for that labor, then the price of labor goes down. And when you have little labor relative to a lot of demand for it, the price of labor goes up. After World War II, we lost a couple hundred thousand people in World War II. The price of labor went up. It was hard to find labor. In fact, during World War II, the price of labor went up.
I mean, what happened is well-paying, low-skilled jobs in the manufacturing sector disappeared. That's the problem. That's what affected African Americans the most. That's what affected all these communities.
Immigration is a
parallel issue.
I'm not disagreeing with you, but you're mistaking the symptom for the cause.
It's a moral problem and exactly what you have to understand is this thing system wide is that these companies move to Mexico, they exploit the labor there. The agricultural sector gets destroyed by multinationals who move to Mexico. People get displaced off the land, and the next place they end up is here.
I'm absolutely agreeing with you there, Mark, although I would say it's not our agriculturals who are going to Mexico. It's what's happening is we're subsidizing corn here, and then we're selling that corn for less than local farmers can grow it for in Mexico. But that's a whole other point. But my point is that you're saying that because our insane trade policies sent all of our factory jobs, or many of our factory jobs, millions of our factory jobs to China and to Mexico and whatnot, and that therefore there's an explosion in service industry jobs and low-paying jobs, and that therefore that, you know, and what I'm saying is, yes, those jobs went away, those factories went away, which is wrong. We need to reverse that. And because those jobs went away, there was less demand, there is less demand for labor in the United States. Because there's less demand for labor, employers don't have to pay as high a price because unemployment has gone up. And because they don't have to, and as long as you've got a surplus of labor, you're going to have low wages. And there's two things that will cause that surplus of labor. One is you do away with the jobs themselves. The other is you increase the pool of laborers. And both of those things drive down the cost of labor, wipe out labor unions, and benefit the profitability of multinational corporations, both the exporting of jobs to China and Mexico and the importing of labor from Mexico.
But the ability to organize, if labor unions have the ability to organize, if they aggressively organize and they can organize workers in those industries, it doesn't affect them as much.
No. You're missing the point, Mark. The ability to organize is a function of the scarcity of labor. This is one of the reasons why the Republican Party is so in favor of the Bracero thing, of the whole thing, that they know that if they can reduce the scarcity of labor, they're going to reduce the power of unions. When you've got people who are willing to work at a union job, who are willing to cross a picket line, who are willing to work for half of the wages that somebody has in with organized labor, or even just a good job, forget about labor unions, when you've got people who are willing to work cheaper, then you can get rid of the people who are working more expensively. And labor can't do anything about it.
Oh, yes, they can. I mean, it's
how?
Called,
you've got a surplus of laborers who will take their jobs.
It's called voting in a union.
Yeah, well, see, and as long as you've got Taft-Hartley in the United States, you've got a whole bunch of states where, you know, good luck.
Right. I mean, and who passes those laws in those states?
Well, that was the Republicans who passed that in 1947.
It's Republicans largely voted for by what? White men. Right?
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you on that. I mean, but I'm suggesting that I don't think that this is an issue of race. I think what we're looking at is the simple economics of, if you want to drive down the cost of labor for a corporation, you can do one of two things. You can move the jobs to where the labor is cheap, or you can bring in extra labor so that you've got labor competing with labor, which drives down the price of labor. Just like
it's not just the issue of extra labor. It's the fact that you have super exploitable labor because people have no rights.
Oh,
and,
sure.
And
that's an added factor.
They exercise them.
Yeah, well, that's an added factor. But, you know, Mark, thanks a lot for the good conversation. I appreciate the call. I got to move along here. It's 10 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
She was just another American mother, lost her son in a war. Death is hard when they go so young, when they die for nothing, it hurts even more. The greatest love is the love of a mother. Out of a substance the body is formed. Out of her dreams the soul goes walking. Sometimes the dream dies hard. God bless you, Cindy Sheehan, for walking this road you are. Many more sons may live a little longer, even though your son is gone.
And welcome back. Yes, indeed. God bless you, Cindy Sheehan. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number. Bob in Florida on the line. Hey, Bob, what's up?
How you doing, Tom? I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
Sure.
I'm the proud offspring of legal immigrants to this country.
So is my father.
And my grandparents came to this country with my mother, who was 4 years old at the time in the early century. And they did what the other illegal immigrants in this country did. They built this country.
You mean the other legally. Legal, the other legal immigrants?
They were legal immigrants.
Right.
They came to this country. They had to wait their turn to get the opportunity to come here. It was something that they were proud of. They paid their taxes. They worked at legal jobs.
Yeah, what we have now, Bob, is we have a situation where the cons have exported our jobs, increasing the labor market in the United States and driving down the price of labor. And
absolutely.
then they let all these illegal immigrants in, further driving down the price of labor. And then they create this national myth that the people to blame for this are white people in labor unions.
Absolutely. And I agree with you wholeheartedly. The way to kill it is to kill the employer.
Yeah.
That employs
yeah.
these people.
Yeah, absolutely. Stop the employers from doing it.
Tremendous fines, felony jail sentence, and no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Walmart had that whole slew of people cleaning their stores, if you'll remember.
They should have shut down the stores. So that's it. You guys, the death penalty. That's it. No more. The death penalty for corporations is what I'm talking about, not for people. But, they when the employers in this country start feeling some pain for breaking the law, then all of a sudden there's not going to be much of a market for illegal immigrants. And then you're going to see the labor pool diminish, and then you're going to see the price of labor go up. In other words, wages go up. Welcome to Economics 101, Econ 101. It's basic supply and demand stuff. Bob, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where our talking points come from, Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Truth in broadcasting. For a change.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone here by the Willamette River in Portland, Oregon, Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back to our program. We were talking in the last hour about immigration. At the bottom of this hour, 30 minutes from now, we're going to answer all your questions about who is Hugo Chavez, what's going on in Venezuela, why is Pat Robertson calling for the assassination of this guy, why is the media allowing him to be portrayed as a communist strongman when, in fact, he was elected in democratic elections that were even observed by representatives of the United States. Why? Why is all this stuff happening? We're going to get into that at the bottom of the hour. But let's wrap up this conversation about immigration. This is a hot topic. Bruce in Akron, Iowa is on the line. Hey, Bruce, what's up?
Oh, thanks, Tom. Well, I totally disagree with your guest and definitely agree with you. The thing I look at is, when I was younger, I read a lot of the Ayn Rand books and, you know, the old Who Is John Galt.
Right.
And, you know, the thing is, I think their whole philosophy is based on basically a false premise, the laissez-faire capitalism, because they failed to take in, or she failed to take into account human nature and the possibility of sociopaths, like in, you know, running corporations who don't care about the common good. And to me, that's, you know, why we need governments to protect the people basically from the corporations.
Right. In fact, one of the reasons why we formed government was to protect ourselves from sociopaths among us.
That's correct. Yeah, and the thing is, I've seen it, you know, in my career. I've been working about 40 years, and I've seen where I lived, like in Sioux City, they got Major Meatpacker there. And the thing is, the illegals come in, and they wind up, it used to be back in about 1973, the pay rate there at one of the packing plants was like about $11, $12.
Which would be about $20 an hour in today's money, $25 an hour in today's money.
Well, they're not even making, they're making about $11, $12 an hour now.
Which means that they're making what would have been $6 an hour back in 1973 money.
Yeah. And so what the deal is, they brought in illegals. They used to, when the workers would go on strike, they would take and have, they had buildings back in, by the plant mat in the fenced area. And they used to keep them back there. And then when there was a strike, they'd bring these people in to work in the plant.
Right.
And there was even an article, like in the Sioux City Journal, there was a gal, her parents were both illegals. And she was proud of them because she said, oh, they worked over there, and they worked in the strikes. And so this is just, you know, a thing of, like, say, the corporations, if you let them what they do, you know, laissez-faire, you know, capitalism at its finest, then they don't care about the people in this country, and they'll use the other people in other countries, illegal or whatever, against us just to keep our wages down and our standard of living.
Yeah, good point, Bruce. We have, in the United States, we've always been fans and advocates of capitalism, but we've had regulated capitalism, a balance between capitalism and democracy. Democracy is a form of governance, and capitalism is an economic system. And unfortunately, the conservatives, the neoconservatives in particular, but the cons by and large today, think that capitalism is a form of governance. And really what that is old-style feudalism. It's plutocracy. It's a ruling corporate class taking over a country. And it's absolutely not what the Founding Fathers had in mind. It's what they fought against. It's what they overthrew in the Boston Tea Party. They fought back against one of the largest multinational corporations in the world, the British East India Company. Bruce, thanks a lot for the call.
Okay,
great,
thanks.
Great to hear from you. I appreciate it. Kenneth in Baltimore, Maryland on the line. Hey, Kenneth.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Great. What's up?
I didn't know if you knew about these banks. I believe there's banks up in Illinois, and I think the other one is in Minnesota, Wisconsin, that have programs set up to provide financing for illegal immigrants to purchase houses now.
Yeah, the Wall Street Journal did a whole a big feature story on it about 2 months ago, right on the front page. Yeah, they have, a lot of banks now are starting to offer loans to illegal immigrants, and the federal government is facilitating it by giving them a number that is not a Social Security number, but which they can use for these purposes. And it, this is just part, in my mind, of the whole, you know, Bush administration thing of try to increase the supply of labor in the marketplace to drive down the price of labor in the marketplace to make more money for what the Wall Street Journal refers to as the investor class in America.
But it seems like, you know, they just got this PR thing to try to make the liberals this weak on the border, and we want this when we, if you take and have a ship and you just flood it with more people than the ship can hold, it's going to, eventually it's going to go down. It's going to sink.
Yeah, yeah.
From the, but it can't hold up the weight, and I think that's what's going on with our own economy right now.
Yep.
It just cannot hold up the weight of all this, and from my understanding, this deficit that we got, I think this has been the greatest deficit we ever had in history.
You're right. Yeah. And no matter how you define it, yes, absolutely. Kenneth, thank you for the call, and thanks for pointing that out. Well said. I mean, this is what people don't get, and it's just, it's amazing. I mean, people understand that if you've got a company in town that's selling cars, you got two car dealers, and one of them starts offering $100 off, then the other one's going to offer $100 off, then the first one's going to offer $200 off, then the second one's going to offer $200 off. Eventually, they're going to reach a point where they can't go any lower. They may even go lower than that. They may even go below cost for a while. But competition drives prices down. Everybody understands that. Why don't people understand that competition for jobs drives down the price of labor? In other words, wages. The price of labor is also known as wages. And if you increase the competition for jobs, then you reduce wages. It's just that simple. And there's two ways you can increase the supply of labor, the competition for jobs. There's two ways you can increase that supply of labor. One is you reduce the number of jobs. And certainly we've been doing that ever since George W. Bush became, actually ever since Bill Clinton passed NAFTA and GATT. We've been doing that by shipping our jobs overseas. And the second way you can do it is by increasing the supply of labor. And, you know, millions of illegal immigrants, yeah, it's increasing the supply of labor. Very straightforward. 1-866-889-8894. David in St. Louis. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, how are you this morning?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind?
Two comments. First of all, in one way, I'm sorry to see communism go, because communism gave capitalism a conscience.
Yeah, at least there was a bugaboo there. That's the amazing thing is all these guys are, you know, like Pat Robertson, you know, communist Hugo Chavez, which we're going to talk about at the bottom of the hour.
Right.
He's not a communist. Come on. He's at the very, you could argue that he's following some socialist policies in that he nationalized the oil industry, and he's using that money to provide for schools, housing, food, and medical care for poor people.
They always have to have an ism that they go after.
Yeah, yeah, it's
I'm going to just talk about, just real quick.
Well, actually, you want communism, look at China.
You know, well,
we're giving all our money to the communists now.
They own most of our debt.
I think they won the war. You were saying, David.
In terms of immigration, you know, my point of view here is we need to look back, step back here a little bit and take a look at things from a different perspective. First of all, what we want is a level playing field where all workers are paid a good living wage, a good wage, not a bare minimum wage on the thing, an environment where we have work and safety regulations that are across the board and where unions have an opportunity to protect their workers across the board. Now, I think, and this is really a radical comment, that we ought to annex everything south of the Rio Grande to the Isthmus of Panama and give those people opportunity for statehood, representation in our Congress, the benefits that they would earn then by being true citizens of the United States. Maybe it's time for an expansion of the United States.
Yeah, the problem with doing that, David, is that, you know, there might be some natural resources there, but basically Mexico and many of the Central American countries have been so badly, not just mismanaged, but basically raped and pillaged for centuries by their so-called leaders, and that they have these firmly entrenched oligarchies. And I've worked down in those parts of the world. Actually, I've worked more in South America than in Central America, but I've been in Mexico and Mexico City and other places. And the oligarchies are so rigid, and there is such I mean, you can't. It's just mind-boggling to walk through the slums of Bogota, Colombia, or Mexico City, and they just go on for mile after mile after mile of people stringing electric wires from cardboard shack to cardboard shack with you know, open sewers running down the middles of dirt streets and dogs, you know, running around looking, eating each other, and it's unbelievable. And you really don't want to, I don't think you want to annex that. We don't want to take on the problems of 200 years of crazy oligarchic policies down there.
Now, you know, I understand it too, what you're saying, and it wouldn't be a quick fix.
Yeah.
But in the long run, you know, we could buy off the oligarchs. I mean, the Bushes could do that in a heartbeat.
It's an idea. It's an interesting idea, and I got to move along, but, you know, thanks for sharing it. I just, you know, doesn't ring my bell. Sorry. Seth in Pittsburgh, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I wanted to expound on what Mark was saying about the race thing.
Sure.
I think you would agree with me that, you know, minimum wage and anything less than that is a slave wage. I mean, it's not enough to live on. So, you know, even the president of Mexico said, you know, that they take the jobs that even blacks don't want, you know. And the truth of the matter is when, you know, like here in Pittsburgh, when we
had the president of Mexico has backed off from that incredibly racist statement.
Yeah, it was. But my point is that what we did here in Pittsburgh
is we
brought people up from the South that were working in agriculture and put them in bunkers and made them laborers.
Yeah, but Seth, let's
be apprentice so they could never join the union and kept them at that low wage. Now that laws had come in, you know, to play since then, we can't do that anymore. So we're going to go to the next thing and go down Mexico and keep that cheap labor going.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean, Seth, and thank you for the call. But the point is about what Chavez was, or what Vicente Fox, the former Coca-Cola executive who's now the president of Mexico, said, is, you know, he said that the Mexicans are coming here to do jobs even blacks wouldn't do. The reality is, what he really should have said, is Mexicans are coming here to do jobs that American citizens won't do. Period. It's got nothing to do with race. American citizens will not do some jobs for those wages. Now, I remember the old Jackie Gleason show, The Honeymooners, right? His best friend, what was his name, Ralph Cramden, I think? He worked in the sewers in New York City. He would come home in his waders from working in the sewers, and they always made jokes about how bad he smelled. Americans will do any job if they're paid well for it. And the bottom line is that Mexican workers are coming to the United States illegally to do jobs that no American citizen will do for those wages. But desperate people who are terrified of being exported, they'll do it for anything. Elaine and Eureka. Hey, Elaine, we're just about out of time. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. There was an article in our local paper a few days ago that startled me, and I wanted to share it. Are you aware that Social Security Administration plans to build a new office in Mexico City?
Oh,
and it's
no.
going to cost $345 billion. And what they want to do is to pay 5 million Mexicans to start with that are here illegally Social Security.
Oh, my. Oh, my. Elaine, it's out of control. I'm sorry, Elaine. We're out of time. I've got to go to this break. It's the tyranny of the clock here. But I appreciate your call. That's incredible. I'll have to look into that. Thank you for informing me. 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
We've got life by the tush. We're the billionaires for Bush. We're determined to keep it that way.
Ah, yes, the billionaires by Bush. They got life by the tush. Welcome back, my friends. 1-866-889-8894. Matthew in Cincinnati on the line. Hey, Matthew, what's up?
Hi, Tom. The reason I'm calling is I just recently finished your unequal protection, and I wanted to instigate some kind of conversation about one of the last things you have in your book, the model ordinances to rescind corporate personhood.
Right.
Now, what I'm wondering is, what does this require? I mean, to put this out there, and hopefully there's a lot of people listening that might be interested.
There's over 100 communities in Pennsylvania that have already done this, and it's being done by the, It's on my the name of the group is on my website. If you go to TomHartmann.com and just click on the unequal protection link, there's a whole website about it. Okay. And it's CELDEF, C-E-L-D-F, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, www.celdf.org. And one of their lawyers wrote those things, and you can go through and get all the information. Okay?
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Matthew. Tomas in Grand Rapids on the line. Hey, Tomas, what's up?
Yeah, first of all, I want to congratulate you on taking such a principled approach. I know you've caught a lot of flack from people on your side of usually on your side of the issues, but you know, that gives you credibility.
Well, hey, right is right and wrong is wrong generally, Tomas, and I think I'm right on this one. I may be wrong, but I think I'm right. So anyhow, what's your point?
I want to run something by you. You know, you were saying that if we concentrate on the employers, but the economy in America right now is not that great. And people are still coming over. And I think it's not just jobs.
Actually, Tomas, the economy is great if you're part of the investor class. The millionaires and billionaires in America are making more money right now than they have made since World War II. They're making out bandits. But it's not great for average working people.
Well, and those would be the people that those would be the jobs, supposedly, that Mexicans will be coming over to take.
See? And they are. And that's the point. As the supply of labor increases, the price of labor decreases. It's very simple. Yeah. Supply and demand.
Well, I think there's other things that attract them. You know, in other words, freedom. In other words, free social services that they're not going to find in those junk.
But we had all that stuff. We had all that stuff in the 1950s. We had all that stuff in the 1960s. We had all that stuff in the 1970s. And it wasn't until the 1980s, when Reagan started dismantling the labor unions, that we lost that first line of defense against illegal immigrant labor. And the Republican administration started encouraging encouraging employers to hire illegals by not discouraging them any longer. And we got the situation we have. Tomas, I got to move along, but thanks for the point you made. Jeff in Boulder. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Tom, let me just chime in on this discussion. I'm reading the book right now, The End of Work, and I think it's a very relevant part of the discussion is that what the outsourcing of jobs to China and other countries and the influx of immigrants into this country is only part of the problem. And the author points out it's actually kind of a small part of the problem. He says that in China recently has lost 1 million labor jobs itself. And what he's pointing out is that the mechanization of working has made sort of workers a little bit obsolete. And
sure.
I think
this was a big concern in the 50s, in the 40s, 50s, and 60s as automation was coming along in the United States. I mean, there were a lot of essentially Luddites saying no. But, you know, I read The End of Work. It came out, about 5 years ago, wasn't it? Was it Jeremy Rifkin who wrote that?
He's got a new edition out.
Yeah, okay. Well, I read the first edition, and you know, I don't agree with him entirely. I mean, he's got some interesting points in there. Jeremy Rifkin is more often right than wrong. But yes, automation is going to decrease the number of jobs. But on the other hand, what it can do, what it should do, the way that automation was sold to us, and Rifkin doesn't really talk about this, he kind of mentions it in passing, or at least he did in the first edition, is that automation was sold to us as a way of increasing productivity. In other words, right now you have to work, in the 19th century, you had to work a 70-hour week. To earn a good wage and to get the job done that needed to get done in order for the product to be made. Now it's only a 40-hour week. You get enough automation, it'll only be a 20-hour week. That's how it should work. Instead, you know, the cons who control the automation say, oh, you can produce twice as much now? Hey, great, we'll get rid of half of you. And, you know, and so they're using it to decrease labor. You get the point?
I do.
Yeah, okay. So anyhow, that's my argument with Jeremy Rifkin. Thanks a lot, Jeff. Good to hear from you. I appreciate the call. It's 29 minutes past the hour. We're going to learn all about Hugo Chavez right after this.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those gnats in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from a field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there.
And welcome back, my friends. Yes, democracy is coming.
From the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Yeah, and apparently to Venezuela as well, to countries in South and Central America. And the Bush administration isn't very happy about that. And Pat Robertson, apparently he's been listening to the vast right-wing echo chamber for the last few weeks, and he just kind of thought everybody was talking about assassinating Hugo Chavez. And so he decided he'd talk about it too, and he couldn't figure out what's the big deal. Everybody's talking about this, right? No, Pat, sorry, wrong. In any case, I wanted to get an expert on about this, somebody who really knows the topic. Ava Gollinger. Am I pronouncing it right, Ava?
Yes, you are.
Ava Gollinger is with VenezuelaAnalysis.com and Venezuela Info, Venezuela...
FOIA.info.
FOIA.info, thank you. And VenezuelaAnalysis.com. And you're a Venezuelan-American attorney and author of The Chavez Code, Cracking U.S. Intervention in Venezuela.
And that's correct.
Your book is available right now?
Well, that's actually ties into the whole discussion. The book is available only through my website, through the VenezuelaFOIA.info site. It's the Chavez Code, Cracking U.S. Intervention in Venezuela, precisely about what the United States government has been doing in Venezuela over the past 4 or 5 years to try to overthrow the Chavez administration. And the book has been published in Venezuela. It's been published in Cuba, but the two contracts I had with different U.S. publishers at different times here in the United States have both been rescinded by the publishers, apparently due to pressure from the United States government.
Really?
Yes, and so actually the book is censored in a way from the United States. It's not for sale in any bookstores because I don't have a U.S. distributor or publisher, and the edition that is published in English available through my website was published by Jose Marti Editorial, which is a Cuban publisher. I'm still seeking a U.S. publisher because the book really needs to be read by U.S. People in the United States and needs to be sold in bookstores.
Ava, when we get off the air, send me an email. And or send an email to Louise, who booked you. You have our email, right? I believe you do. Send us an email. If not, just you can hold on at the end of the break. We'll give you the email address. And I would be glad to connect you with my agent, my literary agent. And I am quite confident he can get that book in print for you.
It's actually the best. It's the best-selling book ever in Venezuela.
Okay, great. Well, let's talk about what it says here. You say the U.S. government has been attempting to undermine the Chavez administration because for the first time a government in Venezuela is taking an independent course. I noticed that Pat Robertson said that Chavez was a strongman, dictator, and a communist. And the American media repeated those words over and over and over again, probably millions, tens of millions of impressions on connecting those words with Chavez's name over the last 2 days, all across the American media, and never challenged those words. They were challenging the idea of assassinating him, but they never challenged those words. Why?
Well, that's absolutely correct. In fact, that's the most horrifying part about this whole situation, because for the first time, actually, Venezuela is making the front pages and is making top headlines, even in local news, which didn't even happen during the April 2002 coup d'etat that briefly overthrew Chavez, backed by the Bush administration. And so here we've got Pat Robertson calling for the assassination of Chavez. It's making top headlines, but you're right. They're not the people who are coming on, or analysts or even newscasters who are questioning the statements of calling to assassinate a foreign head of state, are not defending Venezuela or defending President Chavez. In fact, they're repeating over and over again. I saw it on NBC Nightly News here in New York the other night, where a GOP spokesperson, not surprising, but was the only alternative voice besides Pat Robertson, and referred to Chavez, said, well, he is a brutal dictator. And there was no other point of view to contrast that and point out actually the reality of the situation, which is that not only is he not a brutal dictator, I mean, he's no dictator. He's won three different elections, two presidential over the past 7 years, and one recall referendum, which took place last year, which was heavily financed with more than $9 million by the Bush, well, the U.S. government, actually, your taxpayer dollars, our taxpayer dollars, financed that recall referendum, the opposition side of it. And President Chavez won on all accounts on all these different elections with more than 60% of the vote, which is what we would call a landslide victory. And it currently, even opposition polls in Venezuela give him a more than 70% approval rating. Presidential elections are coming up again next year. So, I mean, that's just to point out the fact that this is no dictator. This is an individual who has been elected democratically in transparent elections on several occasions.
Didn't Jimmy Carter observe one of those elections?
Jimmy Carter actually observed all those elections, but the most recent was the recall referendum. The Carter Center, as well as the Organization of American States, which are the most credible elections observers in this hemisphere, at least, both certified the recall referendum as a completely transparent and legitimate.
Right. And in fact, was it not the OAS who tried to show up to certify the U.S. presidential election in Ohio and was told that they couldn't come in, and so they couldn't certify that Bush actually won the presidency?
That's correct, sure. The United States doesn't open itself up as much as other nations.
But Venezuela did. So this guy is not a brutal dictator. What about the charge that he's a communist? What about the...
Well, not yet. But even beyond the fact that he's democratically elected, because, you know, I mean, recently over the past year, the Bush administration has been trying through the OAS and through other areas to change the concept of what is a democracy and what is a democratically elected leader. And, you know, this is precisely because they're trying to justify some type of intervention in Venezuela. And what they've been saying is, well, it's not just getting democratically elected. It's not just being elected through, you know, a democratic election. It's also how you behave subsequently, which is, you know, this new criteria that the Bush administration is pushing forward.
Right, like if you invade
which they're
other
also
countries.
Judging, which they're on other countries, and they're the judge of who meets the criteria. But in the case of Venezuela, I mean, the accusations from the Bush administration are that there's no freedom of expression, that there's no, you know, your basic civil and political rights, whereas in Venezuela, there is more freedom of expression than you could ever imagine in the United States. I mean, first of all, there's been an ongoing media war since 2001, 2002, since the time of the coup. The major media outlets are all owned by opposition leaders, and they've used the media as a political tool to constantly be, you know, promoting views, opposing, criticizing the government. I mean, not just you know, information, but manipulation, distortion, outright deception. I mean, and they're allowed to do it. There's no media have been closed down, even when they incited to violence, even when they, in fact, called for killing the president, even when they participated in the coup and their role was shown, even when they shut down all programming for 64 days during an oil industry sabotage and constantly called for the ouster of Chavez and the overthrow of Chavez. I mean, throughout all this, there has never been shutting down of any media. No journalists are jailed as they are in the United States. And, you know, nobody has been gagged or muffled for, there's just, you know, it's outright freedom of expression. And in terms of freedom of association, absolutely the same. I mean, people march all they want, you know, they do whatever they want. There's no repression. In fact, it's been a major turnaround from governments prior to Chavez. And I lived there during the 90s. I lived through other governments and a time period when there was, you know, widespread repression by military, by government. And that's just not happening at all anymore. There are no political prisoners in Venezuela, despite the fact that there's been, you know, a coup, and they know who the people who led the coup are. None of them are even in jail. And, you know, ongoing attempts to overthrow Chavez. So, you know, these concepts, this is a government that what's precisely going on is that they've taken, you know, Venezuela is one of the major oil exporters in the world, particularly to the United States. And traditionally, the oil wealth has been embezzled into the hands of the elite and the rich, you know, your typical story. And what the Chavez administration is doing is taking back that oil wealth that belongs, in fact, to the nation. It's a nationalized oil industry since the 70s. And instead of, you know, using the profits to just fatten up their pockets and just for, you know, the wealthiest or to become the wealthiest sector of the country, they're investing those oil profits into healthcare, into education, into job training, into housing, you know, into cooperatives and all different kinds of community-oriented programs to better the, you know, the well-being of all Venezuelans.
Ava Gollinger, which brings us, I'm sorry, you have to let me get a word in edgewise here once in a while.
That's right.
which brings us to the point of my original question. One of the conservative arguments against Chavez is that he is behaving like a communist slash socialist. And what they're saying is that, oh, well, you know, yes, it's very popular to give the people free medical care, and it's very popular to give the people free education, and it's very popular to help them out with housing and food, but that's communism or that's socialism, and therefore we shouldn't tolerate that in our hemisphere. The idea might spread, God forbid.
Well, for one, it's not a communist nation. It's not in the path to communism. I mean, that concept I don't even think would apply in the case of Venezuela, which is a market-oriented economy because of its oil industry. It depends on foreign investment. It depends on, you know, engaging in all kinds of international commerce. And beyond that, I mean, Chavez has labeled, more so what's happening, the process that's occurring, process of change, as a revolutionary democracy, but most recently has referred to it as 21st century socialism, which the reason it would be called 21st century socialism or on the path to that is because it would be a new form. We're not talking about, there's no expropriation of private property going on here beyond any type of legal limits, as you know, that you can have expropriation of private property in the United States.
Sure.
You know, it's called eminent domain. I mean, it takes place here as well. So, you know, we're not talking about a situation where the government's coming in and taking everything over and making it the property of the state.
How is what they're doing in Venezuela really any different than what Norway does with its oil wealth? Norway has all that North Slope money, and they use that to pay for education and health care and schools.
It's more so a country that is similar to a socialist democracy, which most, you know, Western European nations are, that provide, you know, the necessary social programs to meet the needs of their people.
In other words, Venezuela is very similar to Norway.
Well, I mean, Venezuela is, you know, it's a different culture. It's different.
Right, I understand that, but I mean, I'm talking about economically and governmentally. The fact that you've got a democratically elected government and a parliament, you know, or a representative system, and you've got a country that has a lot of oil wealth. That's why I use Norway instead of Sweden, for example. You've got a country that has enormous oil wealth and that is intentionally using that oil wealth to benefit its people rather than, as in the United States, the oil doesn't belong to the country. The oil belongs to whoever's land happened to the first hole down into the ground, into that giant pool of oil, happened to go through.
Well, it's a more, my own personal opinion, and I believe, you know, the reason for what's taking place in Venezuela is because, first of all, the oil industry was nationalized in the 70s. It's not something that happened under Chavez.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, instead of, you know, when you have a nationalized oil industry, those profits are supposed to go to the government, and then they're supposed to be used for infrastructure.
Right.
And in the beginning, they were. And then slowly, you know, corruption grew and grew and grew, and embezzling took place. And, you know, the wealthier grew wealthier, and the poorer grew poorer, and it rose to 80% poverty. So, you know, Venezuela is really doing what it meant to do back in the 70s now, which is use the oil profits that belong to the nation as a whole to invest in the nation as a whole. I mean, it's the most logical concept you could think of if you're thinking outside of the box of neoliberalist capitalist.
Yeah,
you know,
I got it. We're speaking with Ava Gollinger. Her email address, her website is Venezuela FOIA, Venezuela, FOIA .info, and VenezuelaAnalysis.com. We have a caller from Vermont. Do you mind taking a call, Ava?
Sure.
Ronald in Vermont. You're live with Ava Gollinger.
Hello, yes. I wasn't surprised at what Pat Robertson said. He's always advocating terrorism. I mean, him and a lot of them other right-wing preachers like Jerry Falwell. But it's ridiculous with the media, you know, deeming him as what you call a strong man and, you know, a dictator and that stuff. Where is there evidence that Mr. Chavez is a dictator?
Well, that's the
point.
That's the reason.
There isn't any.
There is no, absolutely no evidence. And it,
yeah. Thank you,
know,
you
Pat Robertson. Important to point out that Pat Robertson is not the first person to have said this here in the United States. In fact, the concept of Chavez being a dictator is something that's been floating around and has been, you know, impulsed, in fact, by the Bush administration.
Oh, there's a huge right-wing echo machine around this thing, Ava. I mean, just a huge right-wing echo machine around it. And it seems to me that what they want to do, and tell me if you think I'm wrong on this, my take on what they want to do is they want to remove Chavez, and they want to get somebody in there who is going to denationalize the oil industry and allow ExxonMobil and their other buddies in the oil industry to come in and buy up the oil wealth,
absolutely.
Take it.
privatized, because right before President Chavez won office the first time in 1998, the country was on the verge of privatizing the oil industry. So even during the coup in April 2002, the person who was put in, who was actually the man chosen by the Bush administration, the U.S. government, it's not just Republicans, which is important to point out. Mm. There are a lot of Democrats, you know, who are supporting the Bush administration position towards Venezuela and who have promoted in Congress initiatives against resolutions, different, you know, laws against Venezuela to take action and to condemn, you know, whatever they...
These are Democrats who are also getting money from the oil industry?
Possibly, or their constituents. I mean, there's the case of... there's a Congress member down in Florida who obviously has, you know, who's a Democrat, but his constituency are, you know, in large part Latino, Cuban Americans, and most of the Cuban Americans who live in that area are in other concentrations of the anti-Castro, you know, extremists.
They're upset because Chavez talks to Castro.
Right, they're obsessed with Chavez because he has a relationship with Castro, and they have an exchange going on where Cuba's been providing, you know, more than 19,000 doctors over the past year and a half to Venezuela to provide health care to Venezuela's poor.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. Ava Gollinger, thanks so much for being with us. The website, www.venezuelafoia, as in Freedom of Information Act, venezuelafoia.info, or venezuelaanalysis.com. Ava, thanks for being with us. Keep up the great
work.
Thank you very much. Keep spreading the word. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 10 minutes before the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
God bless you, Cindy Sheehan, for walking this road you are on. Many more sons may live a little longer, even though Casey is gone. The president-elect to his people, he ran when his time came to fight. He's a man without honor or any regret. Justice will gather him, yeah, oh, yes it will.
And welcome back, friends. 4 minutes now before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The right-wing talking point for the day. You're going to hear this on the right-wing radio programs all over the place. They're all going to be going on and on in great hysterical language about how George Stephanopoulos, back in 1997, after he left the Clinton White House, publicly argued that Saddam Hussein should be assassinated, and nobody objected. It's true. It's true. It's over at Newsmax, where you can see ads on how to enlarge your male equipment and how to pick up girls and, you know, all how you can make yourself very, very muscular and learn the Navy SEAL fighting system. And it's really weird. You can learn a lot about a site by just looking at their ads. In any case, over at Newsmax.com, this major story, this big deal, and this I got the email this morning. It was about, I don't know, 7 o'clock local time. The right-wing talking points. And my guess is most of the right-wing shows are going to pick this thing up and run with it. And here's the fundamental flaw in it. What they're saying is that Stephanopoulos arguing that Saddam Hussein should be assassinated is the same thing as Pat Robertson arguing that Hugo Chavez should be assassinated. Saddam Hussein was the dictator of a nation that had invaded another nation that was an ally to the United States. He was a man that you know, clearly and had been elected in an election in which nobody else ran. Hugo Chavez is the democratically elected president of a democratic republic in South America, one of America's major trading partners, who just has the misfortune of sitting on a great large pile of oil, a large pool of oil. Calling for the assassination of a madman dictator and calling for the assassination of a democratically elected president of another nation is apples and oranges. But the cons are going to try and mix them together because they're trying to get everybody to think that Hugo Chavez is sort of like Saddam Hussein, right? Well, he's sitting on a lot of oil that we want. So in that regard, I suppose in the minds of the conservatives, he is like Saddam Hussein. But that's really where the similarities end. Oh, and he will talk to Fidel Castro, a man that, frankly, I have to say, speaking for myself, I would not talk with. Until he at least lets political prisoners out of jail. But that's a whole different thing, you know, just because Castro's a... But Chavez, Hussein, no, no.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, on CRN Digital, WhiteRoseSociety.org, RadioPower.org, Apple's iTunes. Welcome back to our program. Yes, every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his meds. Our phone number, 1-866-889-8894. Alice in Humboldt County, California is on the line. Alice, 91-year-old Alice, always nice to hear from you, Alice. I have so much respect for you. You are still an activist out there, be outspoken and speaking up at 91. I hope that I can do the same.
Well, I hope you can too, Tony. It sounds like Hugo Chavez is providing a far more decent government for his people. That is one reason why the robber barons that stole our government would want to get rid of him.
Yeah.
They think he is setting a bad example.
Yep. Yep. I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. Thank you, Alice.
Okay. Have a good day.
Thank you. You too. Thank you for sharing that. And that's, I'd say the bottom line. You know, that's the point that... that was being made there just a moment ago. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Will in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Will.
Mr. Hartman.
Yes, sir.
Excellent show as always, but I wanted to discuss this illegal immigration from Latin America, in particular Mexico and Latin America.
Certainly.
El Salvador is another terrible problem that is looming for we the people. And you know what? I wish you wouldn't say we want the oil. Refer to the Seven Sisters, you know, or is that how they refer to? Or
you're talking about the big oil companies?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
You had to.
Although I don't think that there's seven anymore because Exxon and Mobil merged. I'm not sure what the number is anymore. That might be why they're not referred to as the Seven Sisters any longer.
Right. They've been dictating policy down there for the last 50 years.
Sure.
Even before that, but I heard that if you would. Now, someone mentioned yesterday, this is about oil real quick, that Sunoco, Citgo, and someone else does not buy its oil from the Persian Gulf, from Arab countries. Is that true?
Sort of. Citgo gas stations. Citgo is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Venezuelan oil company. So if you're buying your gasoline from Citgo, you're buying Venezuelan products, and the money is going to Venezuela and Hugo Chavez, and which is one of the things, by the way, that is chafing the rear ends of the conservatives to no end.
Well, I hope they hear this, because that's where I buy my gas.
Yeah, and I drive out of my way here. There's only two Citgo stations here in Portland to pick up gas there, too, yeah.
Texaco, Gulf, BP are always notoriously 8 to 10 cents higher.
Well, and all those other, you know, BP, you would think it's all from the British North Shore because it's British Petroleum. Really, the reality is that all of the other oil companies, oil is a fungible commodity. If supplies go down in one place, they go up in another place. If you can't buy it here, you buy it there. There's a world bourse, basically, a market, a trading market on oil and oil futures. And so no oil company, with the exception of Citgo, which is entirely... You know, as I said, a wholly owned subsidiary of the Venezuelan oil company. No other oil company can say that their oil is or is not from Saudi Arabia.
Excellent. Mr. Hartman, or Tom, you're one of my famous three Toms, Thomas Paine, Thomas Jefferson.
I'm in good company. Thank you.
Gotcha. I admire you, and I think the world of you. I'll make it very snappy here. El Salvador, its principal export are illegal immigrants to the United States. 2.5, they only have a population of almost 7 million. And ironically, just about a week ago, I saw in my paper that they had a ship with illegal immigrants of over 100-something that died off the coast.
Yeah, this is a tragedy. I mean, we see the same thing with people coming from Haiti and from Cuba and from all these other countries. But the big problem here in the United States, let's be honest about it. I mean, the big problem is people coming in from Mexico. And certainly there are many people coming in from the rest of the Central American countries and from South American countries, and many of them are coming through Mexico to get into the United States. But the point is not, you know, that to vilify Mexico. I'm not trying to vilify Mexico here, or any of the other South American countries for that matter. The point is that we are creating demand for that kind of labor. And you could put up the biggest wall in the world, and those people are going to figure out a way to get in, as long as American employers will continue to hire them. And that's where we need to stop this, is by saying to American employers, if you hire somebody who is an illegal immigrant, then your business is going to be put out of business.
I'm the greatest destructive president in my time. And I'm an activist myself. I'm a fiercely independent registered voter. The worst president I've ever seen was Ronnie Reagan.
Yes, yeah. Ronald McDonald Reagan.
And, you know, he won 8 Academy Awards, you know, for pretending to be a president.
Right. He's the best president who is never the president. Well, there's an old saying. I don't remember what it is. Well, thank you for your point, and thank you for calling and sharing your thoughts with us. I appreciate it.
Tom, I would love to call back tomorrow when you have that wonderful Congressman Bernie Sanders on.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. It's 12 minutes past the hour, 1-866-889-8894. Glenn in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Glenn, what's on your mind?
Well, I want to talk about Hugo Chavez.
Okay.
Well, if you look back in American history, whenever there's a nationalist or a left-wing leader in South America or Central America, we've always sent somebody in there to kill them or put our own leader into power. I mean, you can look at Chile, where we put Pinochet in power and we killed Allende.
Sure. Argentina.
Argentina. And then
Nicaragua.
Well, we tried to kill Hugo Chavez a few years ago, and we didn't succeed,
sure.
And he buddied up with Fidel Castro.
Yeah.
I mean, what can we really expect?
And Castro actually came to power when he came to power in Cuba and overthrew Batista. We did not... Not only did we not stop that, but in some ways we facilitated it because we realized that Batista was damaged goods. He didn't have the support of most of the citizens
right.
of Cuba. And Castro, when he first came to power, he went to the Eisenhower administration. This was after Eisenhower had his heart attack, and basically Richard Nixon was running the government, and said, hey, let's create an alliance. And Nixon said no. You know, you're talking about socialism. You want to have a form of government where, you know, everybody has national health care and stuff like that. And we don't think that that's a good idea. And so what does he do? He says, okay, who's going to be my ally? And the Soviet Union says, well, I will. And boom, on
right.
you go, you know.
And one last thing before I go. The last caller was talking about illegal immigration. The Republicans want illegal immigrants because they're the business owners. They can pay the wages. And
that's
the
right.
Democrats don't stop it because the unions want those people in the unions to make them stronger, and then they want their votes.
Right, which is a sign of the desperation on the part of the unions, and I think is a terrible mistake on the part of the unions. It's you know, cutting off your nose to spite your face kind of thing.
Well, the unions are moving. Some of the unions are moving to the right to try to find these Republicans who are for labor, but when you find them, then you have to take the rest of the baggage with them. So,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
it's never ending.
And the reality is that the unions are suffering from a 25-year war on organized labor that was started by Ronald Reagan. And I mean, you could go back to Taft-Hartley, really, in 1947, the Republicans, pushing that through over the veto of Harry Truman. But, that's really the bottom line. Glenn, thank you for the call.
Thanks a bunch.
Yep, good point. Good point and well said. Fish oil supplement. I just wanted to share this with you. This is... No commercial plug here. Fish oil is really hot right now. Fish oil supplements are really hot. People are using them. It appears that taking 1,000 milligrams or 2,000 milligrams of fish oil every day will ward off depression. There are actually some studies about bipolar disorder in fish oils. ADHD, people are using fish oil to deal with ADHD, particularly in children. And it really seems to be stuff that works because, nobody's sure exactly why, but the reality is that the brain is about 80% fat, and the fat ratio in the brain, a delta, 3, 6, and 9 fatty acids, these fatty acids, the ratio in the brain is identical to that of fish. I think it's because we sort of co-evolved with fish, not co-evolved, that over the course of human evolution, most of human history, if you go back and you look at, the millions of years of human history, most of it was spent along shorelines, along rivers and along oceans. And I think that, fish historically was part of our food supply. And therefore, that balance of fatty acids. Well, number one, you can get that balance of fatty acids from vegetarian sources by buying vegetable capsules where they've balanced the vegetable oils, with borage and whatever it is, flaxseed oil and olive oil and whatnot. But the other thing is, the big problem with the fish oils is that there's some concern that a lot of people, the supplement business, there's $190 million worth of omega-3 supplements, fish oil supplements, sold in 2003, the last number that there are statistics for. However, if the fish oils are not purified, they can contain unsafe levels of environmental contaminants like polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, mercury, things like this. And it is a widespread problem. So Environmental Defense put together a survey. They surveyed 54 major producers and suppliers of fish oil supplements in the United States and evaluated that data, comparing it with EPA stuff. And what they found was that 21 companies have been added to their survey and 7 others have upgraded their status by providing additional information. But 80% of the 75 companies now verify that they're actually distilling. They're using what's called molecular distillation and steam deodorization. They're actually distilling the fish oil to take out these pollutants. And 21 companies, their responses were incomplete. 7 companies did not respond. So, if you're taking fish oil, as I know many people are doing right now, be sure that the stuff you're taking says that it's molecularly distilled or that it's purified or that it has none of these pollutants in it. It's just an important thing. Apropos of nothing regarding politics, but I think that from time to time it's useful to let folks know what's going on. Hugo Chavez, this from Reuters. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, popular with the poor at home, offered on Tuesday to help needy Americans with cheap supplies of gasoline. He says, "We want to sell gasoline and heating fuel directly to poor communities in the United States." Interesting. He didn't say how Venezuela was going to do this, although they do own Citgo, which has more than 14,000 gas stations around the U.S. Wouldn't it be interesting if all of a sudden Citgo just dropped their gas price? Wow. Can you imagine how the gas companies would freak out. They would absolutely freak out. Chavez said Venezuela could supply gasoline to Americans at half the price they now pay if intermediaries who speculate and exploit consumers were cut out the middlemen. Pretty amazing. Now, watch this spot, right? It's going to be really interesting to see how this thing plays out. In the meantime, speaking of oil, the Bush administration has snuck a poison pill into the new federal fuel efficiency standards that they're proposing. I got to tell you about this right after this break. This is absolutely incredible what the Bush administration has put into this bill. It's buried on page 150 of the new rule that, the one that they're saying, this is going to reduce gas emissions. It's incredible. It is incredible what this administration will do to help their corporate benefactors and screw the rest of us. 20 minutes past the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
When sundown pales the sky, I want to hide a while behind your smile. And
and everywhere I'd lurk, your eyes would find.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 25 minutes past the hour.
Love you now.
I love Bob Dylan.
Sweetest thing, twould make me sing. I bet I may as well try and catch the wind.
There you go. Welcome back, my friends. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. The pill that will help you escape the Matrix. Let's change the color, right? From red to blue. It's happening all across the country. Oh, my. And you can drop, by the way, our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. And you can drop by our chat room, our live chat room, by going to tomhartman.com and simply clicking live chat. And, in fact, we had a conservative in the chat room for a while, 5 weeks, who set up a blog, Tom Hartman Watch, right? An anti-Hartman blog. And I thought that was so cool. I've arrived. I've got an anti-Hartman blog out there. And but then he got outed as he was the guy behind the blog, and so he took it down. So 5 weeks, if you're still listening, put the blog back up. I would love to have an attack blog. Hey, Ellen Ratner is with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Ellen.
I want an attack blog.
Really? You know that you've arrived when somebody's bothered to attack you.
Yes. Well, you know, when I spoke to you on your local show this morning, Tom, I talked to you about the fact that we're building this huge army sort of facility or military facility in Djibouti. And that,
yeah, that being a country in West Africa.
That's right. And that it's in the Horn of Africa. And the president's speech yesterday, he spoke about the Horn. And then this general yesterday from CENTCOM spoke about the Horn and how that may be terrorism, etc. Well, they don't have much oil. They do have some natural gas reserves, about a trillion cubic, however, natural gas is mentioned. But as we begin to really analyze this morning, those of us at Talk Radio News, what we began to really look at, Tom, was the fact that it is related to, if the House of Saud falls, they will have troops in Iraq, and if they have troops in Djibouti, that puts you, because if you look at the geography, it's right across the old Red Sea, in a very interesting position to try and secure the oil wells and to try and go into Saudi Arabia to support the House of Saud.
Okay. I was thinking, you know, they're discovering oil all the time along the
Well, they are, but there's no proven reserves at this
Well,
point.
If they've got a trillion cubic feet of gas, they've almost certainly got oil.
Well, yes.
You know, you almost always find them together. But in fact, there's one argument that gas is the byproduct of oil, and wherever you find gas, you should just drill a little deeper. But that's fascinating, that this is all a staging ground for the fall of the House of Saud.
Well, I mean, that is just a series of our analysis. It doesn't mean that it's theirs. But if I know how this government works, that would be my guess.
Now, here's the ultimate irony on this. I wrote about this back in 1997 when I wrote the first draft of Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. The Saudi Arabia was estimated in the 1970s to have roughly 100, as I recall, 100 million barrels of oil in the ground, or maybe 100 billion barrels of oil in the ground. And it's 100 and something. And in the early 80s, they started applying for IMF loans because they wanted to grow the country faster.
Right.
All of a sudden, their oil reserves increased by about a third. And since that time, they've just about doubled their stated oil reserves. Yet they have found no new oil. There has been no exploration. There has been no science behind this. They simply changed the numbers. And now there's a growing consensus that the original numbers were accurate and that Saudi Arabia actually may be close to running out of oil, that their oil wells are old and in danger of failure. So we may be preparing to fight a war for something that will only continue pumping oil for another year or two.
Well, it would be interesting. I actually have a cousin who is a geologist and is an expert in this kind of forecasting. I should get him together with his assistant, or actually the professor he works with, because they have some very interesting views on oil. Maybe we should do a joint interview on exactly this issue.
Yeah, well, this is the stuff that I'm quoting, that I quote in Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, is not a secret. The information is out there. And, in fact, there's a new book about this. I think it's The Twilight of Oil or something like that, but just about the Saudis and Twilight of the Kingdom. And, it's a dangerous thing. Ellen Ratner, thanks for being with us, Ellen.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
There's something wrong with the world today. I don't know what it is. Something's wrong with our eyes.
Yeah, it's called the RNC in Fox News. Welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. I got to tell you what the Bush administration's up to. This is absolutely mind-boggling. There has been a strong call for the last 6 years to increase, well, for a long time longer than that, much longer than that, but particularly over the last 5-6 years, to increase what are called the CAFE standards. The CAFE standards are the Corporate Average Fuel Efficiency, CAFE, Corporate Average Fuel Efficiency Standards. And what it means is that an automaking corporation like General Motors or Ford or Chrysler, Chrysler Daimler Benz, must have across their fleet a certain average fuel efficiency, a certain average gas mileage. And if they don't hit that gas mileage, then there are penalties. Then they have to pay the equivalent of a tariff or a tax on every car that they make that doesn't meet those standards. Now, they've already gotten a bunch of loopholes. If they make a truck, that's not considered a car. It's not CAFE standards. If they make a big enough SUV, it's not considered a car. If it weighs over 6,000 pounds, it's an SUV or it's a light truck, and it's not in the CAFE standards. And so the Bush administration says, we hear your message that average fuel efficiency right now, that the Model T got 24 miles per gallon, and the average car now is getting about 20, 25 or 26 miles per gallon, and that we've actually been higher than that. In the late 1970s, cars were getting better gas mileage than that, and we've gone down. And why? Because, you know, we've been making stronger, bigger cars, heavier cars, and that's, by the way, been driven in large part by the tax break. If a car weighs 1 pound more than 6,000 pounds, then it's not considered a car anymore. It's considered a truck. And a small business can depreciate the entire thing up to $100,000, whereas with a car, you can only depreciate the first couple thousand. You've got to take a long-term depreciation on it. So this was a law, by the way, that was passed to help farmers so that they could depreciate farm equipment. Now, how do you define equipment? Something with four wheels that weighs more than 6,000 pounds. All of a sudden, Land Rover, 6,006 pounds. Chevy Suburban, 6,008 pounds. Or whatever it is. You know, all of a sudden, everybody's just a little bit over 6,000 pounds. So anyhow, the Bushies finally said, okay, we will come up with a way to try and improve these fuel efficiency standards. Of course, we're going to do it in 2016. But between now and 2016, we will do that. We're going to carve out these categories that have to do with the size of the car and all this. And they came up with this little song and dance that really made the possibility of a small improvement. But in the meantime, you've got states like California saying, hey, tough luck. You guys, you know, we don't care what the federal standards are. If you're going to sell a car in California, which represents, what, about an eighth of the entire United States market? I mean, it's huge. If you're going to sell a car in California, it's got to meet higher standards than the federal CAFE standard. We're going to have California standards. And George Pataki, the Republican in New York, and other governors in the East Coast are saying, we're going to do the same thing as California. Now, the Bush administration is suing California in court, saying, you can't do that. California's saying, yes, we can. And there's no law that says we can't. So the Bush administration comes out and says, okay, we're going to have new CAFE standards. We're going to have new corporate average fuel efficiency standards. And, and in USA Today, yesterday, maybe you saw the headline. It was, you know, it was an AP story. It was in newspapers all across the United States. Administration offers new plan to reduce fuel consumption in new cars. Sounds great, doesn't it? George Bush is doing something about it. Until you look at page 150 of the rule. Page 150, buried on page 150, is two sentences, two little sentences that say, and I quote, a state may not impose a legal requirement relating to fuel economy, whether by statute, regulation, or otherwise, that conflicts with this rule. A state law that seeks to reduce motor vehicle carbon dioxide emission is both expressly and impliedly preempted. In other words, what California wants to do will now be illegal. What New York now wants to do, it's now going to be illegal. Sorry, you've got to go with the federal standards, and the federal standards while there's a lot of smoke and mirrors, I mean, this is like the Healthy Forest Initiative and the Clear Skies Initiative. It just sounds so wonderful. And actually, it's an assault on what it's praising. The administration's rules, they really don't go fully into effect until 2016. But states are barred from having higher standards between now and then. Again, the law. Mind-boggling, eh? Mind-boggling. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Bonnie in Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Bonnie, what's up?
Oh, I'm well, thanks. Hey, my fish oil is purified, and it's pharmaceutical grade.
Great. So you're getting the right stuff.
Yeah.
By the way, I just want to toss something in on that, Bonnie.
Sure.
And this actually is a commercial plug, but it's one that I really believe in. Back some years ago, I've always really enjoyed drinking wine. And back some years ago, I discovered that the most heavily sprayed agricultural products of all, everything that you can buy are grapes. And wines, and therefore a lot of wines contain really high levels of pesticides. And so I started buying organic wines. And I discovered this company, the Organic Wine Company out in California. EcoWine.com is their website. And they've got just incredible organic wines. So if you are using distilled fish oil and you want to have pesticide-free wine along with it, check out EcoWine.com, I think is their website. And I had the page. Kareth has the page. Their website, 1-888-ECO-WINE. By the way. So, anyhow, pardon my interrupting you with that commercial plug, Bonnie. What's up?
That's fine. I was wondering, what was the name of the brutal dictator that Pat Robertson dealt with to buy a diamond mine in Zaire, now present-day Democratic Republic of Congo?
Yeah, it was, I don't know about Zaire, but he was in business with Charles Taylor in Liberia.
Oh, okay, it was Liberia. Is that where he has his diamond mine? I thought it was in Zaire.
He may have them in both. I don't know. But I know that when Charles Taylor was deposed, there was a lot of talk I talked about in this program about how he had business relationships with Pat Robertson, had for many years around diamond mines.
Well, he had no problem with that dictator. And I used to watch the 700 Club in the early 80s, I'm ashamed to say. And I distinctly remember seeing Guatemala's former dictator, Efraín Ríos Montt, on the 700 Club being fawned over by Pat. So there's another dictator Pat didn't mind, but he has trouble with, I don't think he's a dictator. He may not be the best politician in the world, Chavez, but, you know, all politicians are politicians. What can I say?
What people have to get is that Pat is a billionaire. Pat Robertson, he's a billionaire. And as a billionaire, his interests are in preserving the wealth of other billionaires. And so he represents the Christian wing of the Billionaires Club.
Exactly.
Oh, I'm serious. And,
I know.
You know, so if you're a billionaire and you're a Christian, then, you know, your politics should be like Pat's. But if you're an average person and you're a Christian, then your politics should probably be more like Jesus's.
But he gets plenty of contributions from those average people.
Oh, I know. Yeah. He's running quite the con job there.
Yes. And on Tuesday, did you say that Utah had no TV stations that allowed Cindy Sheehan's spot?
No, I was wrong about that. I said that, and I was wrong. And several people emailed me to correct me, and I corrected myself on the air the next day. It was the ABC affiliate, I believe, that refused to carry her spot. And the other two didn't. So there was one out of three stations that refused to carry the spot.
Right. Well, I took it, I overheard it, and I thought you were just meaning to be the station manager of them and saying, oh, we're not going to let Utah hear it and things like that. But anyway, I'm glad you corrected it because, well, it became a point of discussion from what I understand. A friend of mine called and asked me, and I said, I must have walked out of the room whenever he was talking, and I just wanted to be your damsel in shining armor and defend your knighthood in distress. Nobody impugns the integrity of my favorite weekday host without a thorough investigation.
Well, thank you. That's very sweet of you. And Be a Witness folks, they are running an ad right now that where they show... They say it starts out where the voice says, while they're telling you this, and then you see a picture of one of the Fox News guys talking about the runaway bride, and then you see Dan Rather, one of the other newscasters, talking about Michael Jackson, and then you see another thing, you know, and it's another thing about, you know, what's her name in Aruba. And he said, while they're telling you this, this is happening. And then it cuts away to a picture of a helicopter exploding in the sky, and then you see all these people, you know, on the ground, you know, refugees dying, and it says, you know, they're talking about the genocide in Darfur. And then they say, how can you stop a genocide if you don't know that it's happening? And then they say, inform your media that you want to know what's going on. Ask your media to be a witness. And it's beawitness.org is the website. That ad, all three networks in Washington, D.C., the local stations in Washington, D.C. for ABC, CBS, and NBC, all three of them refused to run that ad. So there's one, you know, the Cindy Sheehan ad was only one of the three networks in Utah. Idaho, rather.
Sheehan is my hero. And I wanted to say that what was very entertaining, I guess it was the last hour, was a labor guy who disagreed with you. It's so rare to hear a good debate between two people on the left. I thought I died and went to heaven.
Good. Well, hopefully more people who disagree with me will call in. Bonnie, thank you very much. It's great to hear from you. I appreciate it. Unlike many talk show hosts, and I don't understand why they do this, but unlike many talk show hosts, I actually love it when people call and disagree with me. I just, you know, I don't get it why if you try and call the Limbaugh show and correct him, or you try and call Sean Hannity and correct him, or, you know, present the other side of the story, that you don't get through the call screener. Unless you sound like you're drunk. And, you know, if or you sound like you're, you know, you're absolutely incapable of making a point coherently, then they'll go, oh, it's another one of those loony liberals. But, you know, if you're gonna get on and try and make a point, you're not gonna get through the call screener. On pretty much any right-wing show. It just doesn't happen. And, you know, here we, you know, those of you who called in, today Kareth is engineering the program and answering the phones, and she'll say, you know, what's your name? Where are you calling from? And in 10 words or less, you know, basically summarize the point you want to make, and no matter what it is, that's what's on my screen and the software that I see, and that's it. I mean, that's it. It's not, do you agree with Tom or disagree with Tom? Or actually, we should start asking that so I can take people who disagree with me and put them first in line. Because it's good theater, I think. And it's good, it's really good teaching, frankly, to have those kinds of disagreements. Glenn in Tallahassee, Florida on the line. Hey, Glenn, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, so just a little tidbit to add to a couple of things you're talking about dealing with oil production and fish oil. I ran across an article a while back dealing with Zapata Corporation that was co-founded by Bush back in 1953.
Right, Bush and the CIA, by the way. Zapata Oil Company was a CIA front company.
Well, I won't let you go too far down that line because I want to get this out quick and let you go.
Sure.
Hoovers.com is a business website that rates and gives information on major businesses across the world. And also I found an article on Forbes.com from 2001. This one says Zapata sold its energy business back in the 1990s, became a top U.S. producer of marine protein through its majority holdings in Omega Protein.
Really?
Omega Protein's fish meal and fish oil products are used as ingredients in animal feed, human food, blah, blah, blah. They also operate safe. Yeah, listen to this. Safety Components International Incorporated, manufacturer of automobile airbag fabrics, cushions, and technical fabrics. Zapata has 79% ownership interest in Safety Components and 58% ownership in Omega Protein. Financial Malcolm Glazer and family own 51.3% of the company. He's the owner of Tampa Bay Bucks.
Huh, that's remarkable.
And he's
go
ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to say, you know, in 1960, 61, 62... In that period of time, George W. Bush was running Zapata Oil Company. Zapata Oil Company wasn't finding oil, but they did have oil rigs off the coast of Cuba. And the allegations were that they were listening devices. And then we discovered that the actual official code name for the Bay of Pigs operation was Operation Zapata. And the two ships that landed with the people on them?
Barbara and Houston.
That's right, the Barbara J. and the Houston. And it's like, I wonder what's going on here. Well,
there's also United Fruit could be tying on that one doing my reading correctly.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. Glenn, thanks a lot for the call.
You're welcome.
Good to hear from you. I appreciate it.
Sure.
Keith, speaking of, you know, outing folks, Keith Olbermann has the skinny on what's going on with the anti-Cindy Sheehan bunch. Turns out it's not a grassroots effort. It's an AstroTurf effort. It is bought and paid for by Republicans.
Meanwhile, there is the group that reversed the Sheehan equation and showed up in her hometown of Vacaville, California, with a caravan of military families and conservative activists who proclaimed, "You don't speak for me, Cindy."
Now, Keith Olbermann points out, it's not quite what you think.
Several partisan websites reported that the anti-war group Move America Forward was not quite as grassrootsy a response to Sheehan as it first seemed, that it had in fact been launched by a Sacramento public relations firm with strong connections to the Republican Party.
Oh, gee, I'm shocked. The Republican Party hires a PR firm to go after Cindy Sheehan? Could it be?
Those websites are right. While the online evidence has been scrubbed that the PR firm Russo, Marsh & Rogers actually put up the Move America Forward website, Move America Forward still lists as its chief strategist and one of its board members, Sal Russo of the PR firm Russo, Marsh & Rogers. And the Move America Forward fax number in that area code is 441-6057, while the Russo, Marsh & Rogers fax number in that area code is 441-6057.
So then Keith Olbermann, he's got a guest on, and he asked this guy, what do you think about this? And the guy makes this incredible point.
Well, I don't wait on that. In passing, this anti-war group, Move America Forward, they didn't even wipe the fingerprints off this as an actual creation of PR people associated with the Republican Party. Does that surprise you? I mean, have not these guys been real big leaguers in terms of media expertise for 4 years now?
Well, a little-known fact is Sal Russo and his organization were the brains behind the Orrin Hatch for President campaign in 2000. Mm. And that's why we have Orrin Hatch in the White House today.
There you go. That's why we have Orrin Hatch in the White House. I don't know. Should Cindy worry that the Republicans have hired a PR firm to come after her, that they're sending a caravan, a busload of folks down there? Or should we all look at it and laugh? Maybe both. Maybe both. Exposing the con in conservative. With talk radio for the rest of us, I'm Tom Hartman. It's 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I don't always know what the truth is, but a lie isn't that hard to see. Whatever is living in this woman's heart, I hope it'll wake up in me. The rich and the powerful tremble when the truth appears at their door. One simple woman in a state of conviction, and look, I see 10 million more.
Indeed, and welcome back.
Yes, look, I see 10 million more. God bless you, Cindy Sheehan, for walking this road you are on. Many more sons may live a little longer, even though your son is gone.
And welcome back to the radio support group of, by, and for We the People, the Tom Hartman radio program. Yesterday on CBS's early show, the Dan Bartlett, who is the, quote, senior presidential advisor, took the opportunity to clarify what President Bush is saying about the war on terrorism. He was being interviewed by somebody by the name of Smith. I have the transcript here, which only has the last name. Bartlett, not only after 9/11 do we have to go after Osama bin Laden and the people who perpetrated the act on 9/11, but we also have to change our policy in the Middle East. The policies of stability in tolerating dictatorships got us 9/11 in the first place. The status quo has to change. Smith. So you're talking about Saudi Arabia then? Bartlett. Absolutely. Oh, interesting. I mean, you know, because he called him on it. He says, you know, first of all, Bartlett says, not only after 9/11 do we have to go after Osama bin Laden. Well, you know, yeah, we did that for a little while, and then we quit doing that and decided to go into Iraq, remember? He says, but then he says, we also have to change our policy in the Middle East. Policy of stability and tolerating dictatorships got us in the first place, into this 9/11 in the first place. Yeah, because, you know, 14 out of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. So we're talking Saudi Arabia then? Bartlett, absolutely. Whoa! Why is this not in the headlines? Senior administration official senior presidential advisor, Dan Bartlett, saying, yes, we're going to take out Saudi Arabia. And now we're hearing from Ellen Ratner that the president is talking about Djibouti. Everybody's talking about the Horn of Africa because we need to station troops there so that if the House of Saud falls, we can go in and we can occupy Saudi Arabia. Great. Just what we needed. Another war in the Middle East for oil. Brought to you by two oil men in the White House, Messrs. Bush and Cheney. With the senior presidential advisor, Condi Rice, used to be on the board of directors of Chevron, had an oil tanker named after her. Gee, am I seeing a thread here? Something in common? Tragic, isn't it? We'll see you tomorrow, my friends. Same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.